Good evening. The House Judiciary Committee begins hearings that may lead to impeachment of President Trump. Did Osama bin Laden win his war with America? And a walk through Ground Zero the day after 9/11. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI Evening News for Thursday, September 12, 2019. The House Judiciary Committee on Thursday approved a resolution defining the rules of the panel's impeachment investigation, the first vote the committee has taken related to the potential impeachment of President Donald Trump. The vote doesn't need to be approved by the full House. It gives committee chair Gerald Nadler the ability to deem committee hearings as impeachment hearings. It allows staff to question witnesses at those hearings for an hour after members conclude, gives the president's lawyer the ability to respond in writing to public testimony, and allows the committee to collect information in a closed setting.
This committee is engaged in an investigation that will allow us to determine whether to recommend articles of impeachment with respect to President Trump. That is what we are doing. Some call this process an impeachment inquiry. Some call it an impeachment investigation. There is no legal difference between these terms, and I no longer care to argue about the nomenclature. Let me clear up any remaining doubt. The conduct under investigation poses a threat to our democracy. We have an obligation to respond to this threat, and we are doing so. Under the procedures outlined in this resolution, we will hold hearings that allow us to further consider the evidence against the president. At those hearings, in addition to member questioning, we will allow staff counsel to participate for 1 hour per witness, evenly divided between the majority and the minority. This will allow us to develop the record in ways that the five-minute rule does not always permit. We will also allow the president to respond to the evidence in writing and on the record. No matter how we may disagree with him, President Trump is entitled to respond to the evidence in this way. And we will treat certain sensitive evidence, such as grand jury information, as being received in executive session. Under these procedures, when we have finished these hearings and considered as much evidence as we are able to gather, we will then decide whether to refer articles of impeachment to the House floor. We have a constitutional, historical, and moral obligation to fully investigate these matters and to make that decision. Let us take the next step in that work without delay.
The Democrats seem to be conflicted, though. At her weekly news conference Thursday, Nancy Pelosi once again declined to say the committee was conducting an impeachment investigation, only minutes after the committee adopted its resolution stating it was an impeachment.
Legislate, investigate, litigate. That's the path we have been on, and that's the path we continue to be on.
If I may, is this specific language not important? I mean, how should the American people understand
the American
the work
people
of this
understand
when members are speaking very differently about it?
It's not, you're the only ones who are sowing this.
That's not true, ma'am.
It isn't true. I travel the entire country. Come with me sometime, and you'll hear what the American people are saying. They understand that impeachment is a very divisive measure. But if we have to go there, we'll have to go there. But we can't go there unless we have the facts. And we will follow the facts, and we will follow the obstruction that the president is making up, aside getting the facts, and make our decision when we're ready. That's the only question. That's all I'm going to say about this subject. And there's nothing different from one day to the next. We're still on our same path.
Georgia Representative Doug Collins, the top Republican on the Judiciary Committee, charged that the committee had become a giant Instagram filter, that Democrats were trying to dress up what they were really doing to make it look better. And GOP Representative Steve Scalise made light the Democrats' comfort over impeachment, asking Pelosi in debate what their position actually is.
The chairman of the committee, your chairman, today said this is formal impeachment proceedings. He talked about, quote, hopefully by the end of the year, they'll vote on articles of impeachment. Hopefully by the end of the year, there's nothing to impeach him on. And yet they're going to actually go out on a witch hunt saying we're going to look for something. And by the end of the year, we hope to impeach the president. So I'd ask the gentleman, are y'all bringing articles of impeachment to the floor? Is the chairman rightfully going down an impeachment road? And what exactly are those articles? What are the articles of impeachment if the committee today, your chairman of your committee said this is formal impeachment proceedings? What exactly is the gentleman planning on impeaching the president of the United States on? And are you, if he brings those articles of impeachment out of committee, blanks, that haven't even been filled in, if they bring them to the floor, or if they move them out of committee by the end of the year, as the chairman hopes, is the gentleman prepared to bring that to the floor of the United States House of Representatives? I would yield.
Maryland Democrat Steny Hoyer responded to Scalise. He says the Judiciary Committee is just doing its job, sparking an emotional exchange with Scalise.
That's what the committee's doing. I do not want to anticipate what the committee's findings will ultimately be, nor what the committee's actions will finally be. We will wait to see. But it is exercising its responsibility as a co-equal branch of government, as provided in the Constitution. I'm not going to get into the arguments about, Mr. Speaker, the premises and the Mueller report, other than to say I disagree with the characterization made by the Republican whip. That will be for another day to argue that. But the committee is doing its duty, and it will continue to do so. And if it decides that that requires further action, my presumption is it will pursue that as well. I yield back.
I thank the gentleman for yielding, but I don't think the question's been answered, because the gentleman says the committee has a responsibility. And I agree. But the committee has a responsibility to be responsible. And it's highly irresponsible. It's reckless and dangerous for the committee to start impeachment proceedings when there's nothing to impeach the president on.
Hoyer further argued the Mueller report is evidence enough to hold the hearings.
In my view, Mr. Speaker, the Mueller report is replete with instances of cooperation by members of the Trump team with the Russians, page after page after page. Matter of fact, one of them was Page, of collusion. Now, collusion is not a legal definition. Conspiracy is the legal definition. And Mr. Mueller said we didn't look at collusion because it was not a legal premise. And in fact, Mr. Mueller made it very clear that the reason they didn't find criminal wrongdoing was because they believed, under Justice Department rules, a president cannot be indicted during the course of his term. They did not absolve him. And so whether it was obstruction of justice, using a foreign government who is essentially not our ally, not our friend, meeting with Putin secretly and not allowing the American people or the Congress to know what was said, my friend's premise that there is no smoke, no fire, is wrong.
With emotions rising as much as they ever do in the House, Hoyer pointed to what he says were purely political hearings after the killing of American diplomats at the U.S. Embassy in Benghazi, Libya, that led to numerous hearings and criticism of President Obama and then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
8 hearings on Benghazi, 4 lives lost tragically, with an attempt over and over and over and over again to be made a political issue. The 8th committee found nothing there either. So when I hear this wringing of hands, Mr. Speaker, I'm not impressed. I've been here a long time. I've seen irresponsible action, and the American people have seen it. And so the Judiciary Committee is doing what it is pledged to do when they all raise their hands to defend and support the Constitution of the United States of America. The president would like us to think everything is fake news. Now, you haven't used the fake news, but the witch hunt. Poor me. I'm the victim of all these people. When daily the president says things that are demonstrably not true. So, Mr. Speaker, the Judiciary Committee will continue to pursue its duties as it needs to do.
And you're listening to the news on WBAI Pacifica Radio in New York. I'm Paul D'Arienzo. Also on Thursday, House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Elliot Engel subpoenaed the Trump administration's lead negotiator in Afghanistan peace talks to testify before the committee on September 19th. Engel said he issued the subpoena for Special Envoy Zalmay Khalilzad after the State Department ignored requests in February, April, and earlier this month for briefings. He said more than 2,000 American troops have died in Afghanistan, and I'm fed up with the administration keeping Congress and the American people in the dark on the peace process and how we're going to bring this long war to a close. Engels added, I expect to see Ambassador Khalilzad in our hearing room next Thursday at 10 o'clock sharp. Earlier this week, President Trump revealed he had canceled a plan to meet with Taliban leaders at Camp David to finalize the peace agreement. Trump said he canceled the Camp David summit because of a Taliban-claimed car bomb in Kabul that killed a U.S. soldier as well as 11 others. But senior fellow with the Center for International Policy and a former Marine who worked for the State Department on Mideast policy, Matthew Ho, says the failure of the talks is directly related to Trump's disagreement with his former National Security Advisor and committed hawk, John Bolton.
The talks had resulted in what was understood to be a draft agreement of reduction in U.S. forces from Afghanistan in exchange for a limited ceasefire. And then the next part of that, the next stage in the peace process, would be talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban. This is similar to what occurred when the Soviet Union withdrew in 1989. The first part of that process was the withdrawal of foreign forces. And the second part was to be, did occur, talks aimed at bringing about peace within the country. But those talks ultimately failed, mainly, in my opinion, because the United States continued to provide military support to the various rebel groups. What was occurring in Afghanistan was very real. And so it's disappointing to a lot of observers that even though this draft deal that supposedly had been agreed to was far from perfect, and a lot more was going to have to be done, it was still the most work that had been done towards peace in Afghanistan in decades.
Do you think that this had anything to do with the resignation or the firing of John Bolton?
Absolutely, I do. I think up until this point last week, President Trump was very excited about this process. I believe he saw it as his fulfilling of a campaign promise to end the war in Afghanistan. He was going to show that Bush couldn't do it, Obama couldn't do it, and he did what they couldn't do in terms of bringing the war to an end. The United States has escalated the war over the last couple of years. We're now bombing more than we've ever bombed in Afghanistan. We're killing more Afghans than we've ever killed. And then with the attempts at this peace process over the last year, President Trump was going to point at that and say, look, I'm a better commander-in-chief than Bush or Obama was. But then this past weekend, those opposed to the peace process, those opposed to U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan or really any part of the world, that war-making machine that exists in Washington, D.C., kicked into gear. So President Trump was confronted with Fox News hosts saying that he was weak, that he was losing the war, hearing retired generals, all who were on the dime of the defense industry, saying the same kind of thing, as well as what he read on Twitter. And he was upset, and we've seen this before with this president. He basically had a temper tantrum, for lack of a better term, and canceled the talks because he was now being seen as weak rather than being strong. The decrying of the peace talks, the decrying of the peace process certainly has John Bolton's fingerprints all over it, and it had been well known for quite a while that the president and John Bolton were not getting along. John Bolton was not also supposedly does not get along with the Secretary of State or with the acting White House Chief of Staff. So this was the last misstep that John Bolton made in his time in the White House. And I think as everyone who watches this presidency knows, the thing that President Trump is most concerned about is his own ego and his own the view of him from outside the White House. And so being made a fool of by this process not going the way he wanted it to was certainly the last step for John Bolton.
Where do you think this all goes now? What happens next?
That's a good question. That's a really good question. President Trump Monday this week said the process is dead. The peace process in Afghanistan is dead. He said it was because of the Taliban had killed an American soldier. That doesn't make any sense because the Taliban have been killing American soldiers all throughout this peace process. And the United States is committing the most violence that's ever committed in Afghanistan right now. It's absurd and it's kind of hypocritical. On Tuesday, he also reiterated that the peace process is dead. But we're hearing now Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, make comments along lines that it may not be dead. And I think it's just a question of whether the president wants to, how President Trump views this war in terms of his being able to use it for his own image and his own campaigns. I think what's going to come down to is whether or not President Trump thinks it's better to try and get a peace deal so that he can say to the American public and to his base in 2020 that, look, I did what I said I was going to do. I was ending the war in Afghanistan. Or whether it's more important for him to look strong and to not be accused of capitulating or cutting and running or losing the war. I think it's a decision the president's going to make. And the worst part of all of this is that the Afghan people continue to suffer.
With trillions spent in fighting in Afghanistan and later Iraq and maybe a million dead in total, can it be said that Osama bin Laden, purported mastermind of the 9/11 plot, was correct when he stated that America would destroy itself if it attacked his base at the time in the mountains of Afghanistan?
I very much believe so. At one point in 2004, bin Laden was quoted as saying, all you need to do is send two mujahideen to the furthest point of the globe, plant the flag of jihad or declare jihad, declare war basically, and the American generals will come running and they will bankrupt, they'll morally and financially bankrupt the United States. And he's absolutely true. I mean, look at the state we're in right now worldwide. We don't even know how many wars, how many places the United States has sent young people to be killed in or to kill. Various journalists, Brown University, other organizations such as where I work at Center for National Policy, it's somewhere between 15 and 22 nations in the world since 2001 the United States has seen combat in, and that is primarily in Africa and the greater Middle East, extending from Libya all the way to Pakistan. So, and the cost of these wars, not just the personal cost, well over a million people have been killed in these wars. You have this massive refugee crisis, which has its roots and its reasons in these wars, but also then financially for the United States. The costs are estimated at being upwards of $6 trillion, including long-term care for veterans, as well as debt payments. One of the things I point to, the number I point to, that people are always shocked by is that the amount of money we spend on debt payments each year. This year, the United States has spent $150 billion on debt and interest payments on past wars and past military spending. The economists at Harvard University and at Brown University have calculated that just in debt and interest payments alone, we have spent, the United States has spent $750 billion for the Iraq and Afghan wars. So get back to your point about bin Laden being correct in his strategy. I think that's absolutely the case. We've expended ourselves financially. We've expended ourselves bodily and most especially morally.
Matthew Ho is senior fellow with the Center for International Policy and a former Marine who worked for the State Department on Mideast policy. 18 years ago, first responders were answered by a small volunteer army of volunteers and city workers who descended on the ruins of the World Trade Center in a search for wounded and injured that soon became a recovery operation. As a reporter for WBAI in 2001, I spent Wednesday, September 12th that year speaking with people in the streets around Ground Zero. Here are some of those interviews.
I'm beginning to see the sheets of paper, the real harbinger of this disaster, and one of the most amazing things are just like the millions and millions of 8.5 by 11 sheets of white paper, many half burned or singed around the side. They start to really line the streets as we head up this way. And the street is blocked at Exchange Place. I think, though, I can make a left turn there. And the area, the block behind the stock exchange is blocked off and guarded by police officers. It's just so thick and dusty, and most people are walking. The police are not allowing people to to walk up this way.
Excuse me, gentlemen, I'm from WBAI Radio, and I was wondering if you've been working over there, if I could ask you your experiences and your what you're thinking about.
I don't even want to think about it, but it's too much.
What do you do? You work for the MTA, you work in the subway?
Yes.
And have you been down in the subway tunnels, or where have you been?
No, we was right actually at the where the building fell off. Yeah.
What did you see when you were there?
Too much. I mean, picking up pieces, body parts, and, you know, it's horrible, horrible, horrible.
Basically, are you finding any survivors or hearing any notices?
Well, this morning they found a few survivors. I believe there were 5 or 6 people they found alive. But after that, that was nothing else after that.
Were you involved in trying to rescue any of the survivors?
Well, we were there, you know, so we have assistance from the fire department and the police.
How long have you been here?
We came from this morning, it'll fly.
What do you think about this? What did it make you feel? Did you realize what you were going to see when you came?
You know, it's a mixed feeling. I mean, anger. But then, you know, sadness also. It's quite a mixed feeling.
Did you ever think you'd ever wind up?
I'll never in my lifetime. I always thought maybe something could take place in this, you know, but not at this magnitude, nothing like this.
You saw a lot of people die.
Well, they was picking up parts. I mean, pieces are, you know, and they're still digging. I mean, I'm pretty sure when they go down there, that's where they're going to find a lot of. It's a lot. It's horrible.
What's your name?
Joe.
WBAI Radio, I was wondering if I could ask you about some of your impressions of today, the work you've been doing today.
Work we were doing was minimal compared to the fire department and all the other services. It's terrible just to see the guys walking around with the, you know, you just have to feel for the firemen and the cops, everybody that's in there. But I wish we could do something. I wish we could get in there and help. But everything teetering all around us. Very dangerous situation.
What are you mostly doing? Cleaning up debris. I noticed all the dump trucks were coming through.
We were cleaning up for the transit authority. We were cleaning up the stations, the entrances to the stations, vent bays, clearing them off, prevent water coming down into the subway when they wash the streets down or whatever. You know, it's just.
Do you expect to have service here anytime soon?
I don't know. There's still problems. There's other problems. Nothing to do.
What in your gut? I mean, what was the emotional feeling of some of the sites I've heard told? I mean, people being dead, and bodies.
I have friends that are unaccounted for, firemen, friends of mine. There's no words to describe it. Nothing.
Can I ask your name? First name is mine.
Matthew.
Thanks.
How you doing?
From WBAI Radio, I was wondering if you could give me some of your impressions of today's work, what you've been doing today.
Well, a lot of things. We've just been working like everybody else. It's just hard. Can't even believe it.
Clearing out the subway entrances and things like that.
Oh, yeah. So much of it.
Uh-huh.
Really is.
Do you think it'll be done anytime soon? How long do you think it'll take?
Oh, I don't know. Probably about 2 weeks. Looks like a lot. 2 to 3 weeks.
Just to clear out the debris.
Oh, man. Who's to know this is going to happen? This is unbelievable. It really is. A lot of people out there, you can still hear their voices.
Really?
Sad.
Well,
we tried. Yeah, we're trying, and we're working on it. These dogs have worked everyone, every crew. I think all the crews together have done well.
You have dogs that are helping you?
Oh, absolutely.
Have you heard any sounds yourself? Did you hear any?
No, but what I understand, I was close enough to hear people tell me it, so you got to believe it. Yeah, it's incredible. Did you get to see it, too?
I was here yesterday when it happened, yeah.
It's unbelievable.
I saw most of what happened. I didn't see the actual hit, but I came in a few hours afterwards, and it was like hell.
It's unbelievable.
Were you here yesterday or just...
No, I was on 14th Street yesterday, and I seen the building go down. I witnessed that second part. It was just phenomenal. God help
you. What you saw? Did you believe
it? I tell
you. What did you think?
But like everybody else, you panic. You just don't believe it. I don't even think it registered in our heads. I really don't, as far as what's happening out there. You just got to give a lot of people credit. We were donating blood yesterday, last night. I was very impressed. You know, New Yorkers get a bad rap. They really do. For being bad, for being this. But I tell you, I was most impressed to see so many people donating blood, giving water to people online that were giving blood. It just made you feel good.
Donations of stuff, equipment, and
food. Things. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was just great to see that in the wake of everything else that's going on. I mean, it's and again, you got to keep in mind those buildings are pretty unstable.
Right, they're still
right now, right as we speak, those buildings there, I can hear the crunching.
Are you working with the transit authority?
No, I'm just a volunteer, just helping. I've been on South Cal where we were pulling out debris and bodies today. So. I was with some firemen, and we were pulling out a lot of rugs. And I have a knife on me, and I gave him the knife, and I thought he was going to use it to cut a rug, because that's what I thought. It was a rug, but he started stabbing it, and he said he just wanted to make sure that it was a rug. And I didn't know what he meant until we found the first body, and in the first body, it looks like a rug. It looks like a carpet inside out, and they were just messed. So there was no, not complete, you know, no faces. It's just a shame. Where I was, I seen at least 11 body bags go out, and I personally seen two bodies. You know, so.
How long have you been here?
I've been here since 9 o'clock this morning, and I was here last night.
Really?
Yeah, I went home.
What was it like last night when you showed up?
Well, it was full of smoke, dust, fire. They were still putting out the fires. It wasn't a lot like we could do for as far as rescue. Basically, we just cleaned up in front of Liberty, at the end of Trinity and Liberty, just tried to clean up there some so that we could park things the next day and get the lights. I helped set up the lights for overnight. It was pitch black.
Fire's pretty much out at this point, do you think?
Well, they have hoses around. It's smoldering. You know, they're checking the buildings. I think they're pretty much out. At least in South Tower, it looks like it. In South Tower, I don't know if you know, if you go up on Liberty and Trinity up there, you'll see a pile of debris. But if you go over that pile of debris and get on top of that, there's a pit that goes out 100, 150 feet. A big, giant, vast hole. And I would imagine there's a lot of people that's in there. Right, exactly, where the basements are. Just a giant hole. Yeah.
Well, how did you get involved? Why did you decide to volunteer? What do you have expertise in that? Or you
well, I've had some medical training. I'm American, and that's bottom line, and I wanted to be there. I wanted to help.
Where are you from?
I'm from Staten Island.
So how did you get over on the ferry?
Yeah, got on the ferry. I had come over with Frank LaCoury, Water Mains. They had volunteered a lot of their trucks, and I jumped on with them. And then I came over here today, and I just pitched in whatever I could, you know.
What's your name?
Dan Schmidt.
Yeah. What do you do for a living?
I'm a milieu counselor at Jewish Board of Family Children Services, Geller House in Staten Island. And my boss, I talked to my director today, Beryl Kendi, and she let me off to come do this. Yeah, so, anything? Not that I know of. I've known some people that their parents, like one of my stepkids' parents, works in the 102nd floor, but I don't really know them, you know. Yeah. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we were just at one of the triage centers, and so they were sounding the horns to get away because the building's going to come down.
What is a triage center?
Well, generally a triage center separates the more serious from the less serious people and allows you to attend to the more serious people and give someone a bandage or something if it's less serious. But we were mostly just rinsing out eyes and giving oxygen to people and treating kind of exhaustion and stuff like that.
People were actually working here.
Yeah. I just saw body bags. I didn't see anybody come out of the rubble.
That's what folks I talked to said, that as opposed to 1993 when this happened, there's a large flood of wounded and injured, and this time the emergency rooms are silent comparatively.
Yeah, we're actually from New York Methodist, and we came down from Brooklyn to help because we were put on alert yesterday, and there was nothing really that we could do, so we thought we'd come down here today and try and help.
Working with the bodies and helping them.
It's just busy. I mean, there's not, I don't know, I didn't really get a feeling of morbidity or anything like that. They're just people kind of focused on what they're trying to do and stay safe and busy. So we kind of, we had a run a few times, went back and forth, and we've been trying to find the rest of the team that we came down with.
And that's some of the news for Thursday, September 12, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.